Gentlemen, welcome to the Manned Spacecraft Center. We appreciate your giving up your weekend for a session of work here. This is not really the usual kind of symposium. It's designed more for the people that are putting it on than for the audience. In other words, it's more like a working session in which we hope to get a hardcore review of the lunar mission and the documentation of it here during the next 3 days. We have designed it so there's adequate time for discussion, and we hope to get the participation of the audience and useful comments and inputs throughout the session. You all have a agenda. I have to say that some of the papers are quite long and will be fairly highly technical, but that's why the makeup of the audience is what it is. It's a really represents the hardcore of the lunar mission experts in the country. Without taking up further time, I'd just like to say welcome again. Thank you for coming to help us, and I'd like to introduce General Phillips for a few remarks.
Thanks, Dr. Gilruth. Gentlemen, in the course of our work to plan and execute the development of the Apollo space system, we've committed ourselves at this point in time to a set of technical requirements and a set of configurations for vehicles and hardware, generally for software, for crews, ground and flight, and for facilities and quite a wide range of support, which we believe to be entirely adequate, both in capability and in flexibility, to carry out the manned lunar landing. Now, all of the elements of this system either have been or they're scheduled to be very rigorously evaluated and qualified by testing and by analysis on the ground before flight to demonstrate and ensure that the requirements that have been set have been met and that we're ready for flight. Now, in the next several months, we expect to carry out a series of flights in Earth orbit to do several things. First, to make those tests that we can't do on the ground, and there are a few of those, to progressively verify that the performance and reliability of the system is up to what it ought to be, and to acquire the experience that's necessary to ensure that we have a mature system. Now, these flights, which are going to be described in following talks, involve both the Saturn 1B, the Apollo Saturn 1B, and the Apollo Saturn 5, and they converge rather rapidly on the flight of a lunar-capable space system, and that's over a relatively few months. Now, it's been our practice to subject our hardware and our software to critical design reviews as the program has developed. It's also been our practice to subject the details of our program plans and of our flight plans to extensive technical and management reviews. As we here know, but sometimes tend to forget, I think, the lunar mission is going to be a real tough mission. There's a lot of hard work that lies ahead in the way of detailed planning to operate within the flexibilities that have been designed into this system. And there are a lot of hard decisions that lie ahead. I think it's particularly appropriate and very timely to review in detail the lunar landing mission itself, to subject the mission to a critical design review, if you will, and particularly focus on the operations either on or in the vicinity of the moon to a critical review. Now, the agenda which the Manned Spacecraft Center has put a tremendous amount of effort into, is constructed to do just that, to talk through the mission with emphasis on the critical phases where we undoubtedly have the most work remaining. I think it's particularly significant that everyone here has a direct responsibility for executing some portion of the Apollo program that will lead us to the lunar-capable Apollo space system. Represented here are the government, the industry, the science, and the various advisors that all have direct responsibilities for the execution of this program. It's our purpose here in the 3 days ahead of us to take time out from the rigors of the discipline schedule that everybody's working so hard to achieve within the cost controls that currently are receiving a lot of attention, to focus our effort and attention and gray matter in particular on this lunar mission. Our objective is to produce at the earliest possible time the lunar-capable Apollo space system. Now, the purpose of this symposium is to ensure that the right things are being done in preparing and planning for the execution of the actual lunar mission. It's our purpose in the conduct of this symposium to clearly identify any additional actions or any redirections of actions or efforts that these critical reviews of our plans might indicate. With that, I'd like to turn the meeting over to Dr. Joe Shea, the Apollo Spacecraft Program Manager. Joe?
Thank you, Sam. According to the agenda, General Phillips has gotten us ahead of schedule, and as usual, it will be the centers that get us behind. The sessions are going to be kind of long. This is a, I guess, slightly ambitious undertaking. I'd like to just try to put it in perspective as we move into it. Before doing that, though, mission itself has been coming along reasonably well in planning. I'd like to emphasize just a few points for something like this. We have been working actually, since 1961 on what the lunar mission ought to be. And by and large, since the middle of 62, we've had the same nominal mission. I could go back to the kind of things that we did in the mode selection operation when we were trying to pick whether it was direct flight or EOR or LOR. And the mission today is very much on the surface like it was when we went through those studies. The differences really lie in a large amount of detail that has increasingly been put into place on the program as we've gone down and studied more and begun to write the equations and looked at what the hardware actually can do. And so we're in a situation where what we're doing in this symposium is really going down about two more levels of detail than is conventional in these kinds of discussions, the object being to show in almost nauseating detail how it is it's going to get done. Now, I'll make a second point. There is no such thing as a unique way to do the mission. And there's no such thing as a unique way to do individual parts of it. And so, again, I would emphasize that what's being presented is the present approach. We don't claim that it's necessarily correct in every sense. We don't claim that it won't change somewhat between now and the time that we do it. And we certainly don't claim that it's unique. On the other hand, in terms of things that are being done, choices that are being made, the question of do you do it this way or do you go back and try to do it some other way is a question of whether the way that you're going now will work and is adequate rather than whether it's the best you might think of if you went back and started from scratch. And I think that's an important point. Every one of us, if we were going to lay it out and do it completely by ourselves, which we probably wouldn't be able to do in this decade, but aside from that, we all, by and large, intellectually seem to think we can do it all by ourselves. Were we to do that, we'd come up with slightly different versions of it. And my point really is that what we have here is the way it's come out through the somewhat random process of designing these kinds of things. And I would submit that the kind of questions we have to ask are questions of, is there a gross flaw in what's going on, rather than, gee, can I do this a little bit differently and a little bit more elegantly or a little bit more cutely or even a little slightly better. Now, in order to put it in perspective, before Owen Maynard goes through the first of what will be several runs through the mission from various points of view, I'd like to run down what I consider to be some of the major considerations in the design of the first lunar landing mission. There is an outline of these remarks, as there are of everybody's remarks, in the handout that you've gotten, so I'm not going to belabor the points. Start out by saying that the thing that we're talking about is really the first mission. We're not going to go into the details of the ground test program or the Earth orbital missions which lead up to the flight mission, nor are we talking about missions on beyond the first landing mission. We are in effect here talking about the first mission, and a few peculiarities associated with that mission are going to creep into the discussions. As a matter of fact, that touches on the first point, because the first mission, the way we conceive it now, is what I would call an open-ended mission. What I mean by that is that we will, in the Earth orbital program, have in effect tested each part of the system in and around the Earth in what you might think of as the best simulation of the lunar mission that we can do, constrained by being close to the Earth. We'll then finally, on some flight like 504 or sometime thereafter, commit to the lunar operation. Now, it will really be the first time that we've gone out more than about 5,000 or 6,000 miles from the Earth. Things could happen as we move along, and the general concept that we have for the mission is that we keep it going as long as everything's going properly, in effect continue this philosophy which is in the test program of capitalizing on success, but noting that there are a discrete set of decision points, and the decision to continue the mission or to stop the mission or to modify the mission will be made at discrete points along the way. If everything continues to operate properly, the first mission would be a landing mission. If there are problems of any significance along the way, depending on what that problem is and where it occurs, the mission will be stopped, changed, or brought back. So it's open-ended from that point of view, very much the same as the first manned Apollo, 204, is going to be an open-ended mission. We're committing to, it turns out, although we initially used to talk about having an ability to launch any time during the month and so on and so forth, that as you begin to pick up all the various constraints which seem to be useful, at least for the first landing, it turns out that limitations start to come in. And the thing that we'll be proposing, and Owen will go through in detail on exactly how it's done and the reasons for it, is that there will be, in any given month, roughly 3 days which you could do the mission, those 3 days being separated by 1 day each, so that it's like the first day, the third day, and the fifth day. The reason for that is the recycle time associated with the launch vehicle. Associated with the 3 days will be three different launch sites, because one of the major constraints which we have left in the program at the present time is the question of the lighting at the moon at the time of arrival for the landing. And for that reason, since we're limiting the lighting conditions to something like the sun 7 degrees to perhaps 20 degrees above the surface or above the horizon over the astronaut's shoulder, that means that if we're going to recycle from day one to day three, we're going to have to move something like 26 to 30 degrees across the moon in order to handle the shift of the lighting conditions. And so we wind up then, for the first mission, in effect having to prepare three sites and be ready to go to any one of three sites. And that will turn out to interact back then in the question of the site selection, the training, and all that there kind of stuff. We're talking about data for the sites coming really from three sources: Earth-based information, the Orbiter A information, and the Orbiter B information. This will be discussed again in more detail. And we are, in essence, carrying a concept that says surveyor will confirm the combination of Earth-based and orbiter information by, I'm not sure what the word would be, but essentially not by certifying an individual site, but rather by telling us in general what the lunar surface is like at a specific point which has been observed both from Earth and from the orbiter, and by extrapolation we would then presume that we know the details of the surface at the other areas. We are not proposing to land for the first missions at a surveyor site itself. Okay, another point is that the mission, when it's run, independent of what the spacecraft actual weight turns out to be at the time of the mission, we would propose to load the spacecraft with maximum propellant and consumables that are consistent with whatever the launch vehicle capability is at the time that we go. And that just says you want as much fat in your pocket as you can get away with. An inherent concept on the translunar and trans-Earth phases of the mission is the use of attitude variation to control the spacecraft's thermal extremes. This has been one of the, let's say, design trade-offs that we've gone through actually a couple of years ago. Concluded that we would ease some of the hardware design problems by eliminating the requirement that the spacecraft be in an arbitrary attitude for prolonged periods of time. This means that you don't then see the extremes from, say, minus 250 to plus 250 that you can see on the surface of the spacecraft, but rather control those extremes so they run from perhaps minus 100 to 150 up to plus 100 to 150. We've saved some weight in the heat shield, we've saved some material problems in the heat shield, and also some temperature control problems in the service module itself. And so that's an inherent part of the overall mission concept. We're talking about using the manned spaceflight net as the prime navigation source. This is not to say that we don't have the capability to navigate on board. We do. But tied in with the conservative use of consumables during the mission, particularly the reaction control system capability, and the requirement for attitude control for the thermal reasons, we tie this all into the use of MISFIN as prime and the onboard as an emergency type operation. In terms of the use of the LEM, we are talking about the LEM as a valid backup, or the LEM descent engine actually, as a valid backup to the service module engine through lunar orbit insertion. We're talking about using free return trajectories through lunar orbit insertion, and the definition of free return is essentially a trajectory such that you are never further away from free return than say, the amount of delta V associated with the RCS system itself. We will be using, when we get in lunar orbit, a limited number of landmark sightings from the onboard system to help tie down the link between MISFIN and the moon. As far as the landing site itself is concerned, there are really three possibilities. One is a general area landing, in which it interacts back with the guidance equation mechanization, but basically the general area landing would be a fairly large area, perhaps 10 miles long, in which any point in that area is an acceptable landing site. That's one type of landing. The second would be a more specified area, in which basically it's the same kind of thing. Any point within an area governed by guidance dispersions itself would be acceptable. The CEP of the guidance system, Cliff will go through this, is about half a mile. So this means on a three sigma basis somewhere within a mile and a half or so of any individual landing point. The third thing would be landing to a specified point. There are significant interchanges in the utilization of the fuel that you have available in the descent stage, depending on which of these three things that you pick. I suspect that we'll wind up wanting to land at a specified area as distinct from an actual point. The main trade here being that if you land at a specified area, you can, in effect, save a fair part of your fuel for the hover and touchdown condition, or the analog of the hover and touchdown condition, rather than use it to adjust to come in to some particular point. I suspect this concept is going to be one of the things that we'll continue to talk about for long periods of time, until we select the actual sites themselves, until we know what Surveyor and Orbiter have done. But I would just make the point today that capability will exist for any one of these, and the various trade-offs will be pretty well discussed in the papers that will follow. We are proposing the use of the crew. It's inherent. Excuse me, I don't mean to say it that way. It's inherent in the system that the crew is used integrally throughout the mission, particularly in the landing, on the survey of the site, the avoidance of local obstacles, and in the touchdown itself. As a matter of fact, when we go through the landing dynamics operation, you'll see that there is a relatively large landing envelope in terms of vertical and horizontal velocities and attitudes. The magnitude of that envelope is governed primarily by the requirement that we've carried in the program that we be able to land blind from some altitude like a couple of hundred feet because of the presumed interaction with the dust. Now, as we begin to get more information, I'm not sure we can yet say that there isn't any dust, but I think it begins to look fairly encouraging. If there is visibility to touchdown, then you'll find that velocity variations, I think, will be a lot smaller than the kind of things we're talking about. And if we ever conclude that we really can presume that we can see all the time, then we can actually simplify some of the mechanization of the landing and touchdown operation itself. We will describe in some detail the operations on the lunar surface. Fundamentally here, the main point is that we would propose for the first mission that we stay something like 18 hours on the surface, that there be two joint excursions, joint being both astronauts out at the same time using the buddy system with the LEM untended, and two such excursions would constitute the first mission. And there'll be a pretty good timeline developed for what goes on in the mission operation. We're talking about the concentric flight plan for rendezvous, and the sensors involved are the LEM with a radar, the CSM observing the LEM with optics, and MISFIN observing both, and in effect using the tracking capability as a redundant check. And we'll go through that mechanization in some detail. One of the main setters of the requirements for reaction control system consumables in the CSM is the capability for the CSM to rescue the LEM in Earth orbit, or excuse me, in lunar orbit, and that continues to be an inherent part of the overall system operation. We come back home. We're talking about water landing. You'll find that throughout the mission we have an essentially continuous abort capability, translunar, descent, and up to and including touchdown, and we'll go through the ability, which we think we have, to actually stage the LEM after impact if for any reason the impact dynamics are going to cause the thing to tip over. I mentioned that we have the crew in as essential systems elements throughout the overall thing in addition to landing. And we have a series of points that Owen will make in his briefing. We have what you might think of as accumulators and decision points in the overall mission flight plan. These accumulators are places where you can stay and, in effect, mark time if you want to get ahead or behind of your mission plan, if you're running into troubles and you want to rest or in any way modify your mission. You can do this by changing, to a certain extent, the number of Earth orbits that you utilize when you first go off, the number of lunar orbits that you have before landing. The surface daytime is obviously adjustable. The number of orbits before rendezvous after the LEM comes up off the surface, the number of orbits that you stay around the moon after the rendezvous is completed before you come back home. We do have plans for nominal and backup modes of operation for each of the mission phases, by and large, although we're not going to go into the details of the subsystem mechanizations in areas like environmental control and so on and so forth. We we by and large have a capability to set up in nominal and backup modes, and actually the amount of redundancy is quite significant when you really lay out all the different ways in which the spacecraft can be operated. We're talking an essentially continuous communication capability. You obviously lose some communications when you're behind the moon. In addition, the attitude control during translunar and trans-Earth will occasionally cause breaks in the communication, which we don't consider to be very serious. There are inherent precautions in the program at the present time for contamination, precautions against contamination, both of the lunar surface and of the Earth. We are prepared to discuss these if you want to get into them. We don't plan to make a major point of it right now, except to say that we're putting in what I would say is a reasonable set of precautions. On the other hand, you should recognize, and I think people do recognize, that as long as we're using men, there are biological products generated by the men, and there is a lower limit of contamination, particularly of the moon, which is essentially unavoidable. So the question is not one of being absolutely clean, but how dirty do you want to be kind of thing, and I think we have to balance that off against the pain that it causes us in the system design. I've mentioned the discrete mission decision points, and I just observed that there are a few things that will, up to, I think, the day of the flight, turn out to be concerns that we really not going to be able to answer until the mission itself goes. The first of these would be environmental effects. We seem, even up to the present time and the Gemini program, to continue to get occasional surprises about environmental effects. And I would just emphasize that this first lunar mission will be the first time we will have been out in deep space. It's the first time we will have been truly in that thermal environment. There could be some things that would come up and nip us. We don't expect these things to be there, but we have to be prepared to be surprised, in effect. A more significant point is what I would call a calibration of the navigation and guidance system. Despite the fact that intellectually it seems clear that you should be able to design the GNN systems so there are no biases and so the equations are correct and so that you don't have mistakes, by and large, it has not been our experience to date in these programs that that's happened. In fact, in almost any GNN program, you find the first few times that you use the system closed loop, it doesn't do exactly what it theoretically ought to do. We've noticed it in Gemini. If you see the misses in Gemini have been coming down. In effect, it's because the system's been getting calibrated. Same thing happens in some of the ballistic missile programs. And the concern that I have is just that the first mission is the first time we'll be using that GNN system out at lunar distances. And there is a reasonable chance that we're going to find biases and funny little things in it. And I think we have to really be set up for the checks and balances using independent sources and so on to be darn sure we're not getting ourselves out in left field. A third concern is the landing itself. Again, it will have been simulated, tested, played with as well as we can here on Earth, but we are not, as you well know, able to simulate to our satisfaction the actual use of a LEM touching down in a 1/6 G simulation. So the first time that the job actually gets done for real in a LEM is going to be the landing itself. So the simulations here have to be good. And the last item of concern is the one that by and large I think is coming out of the Gemini program. And this is the fact that you can load the crew too much, and we need to be careful about the timelines. And we need in the lunar mission, I think, to be particularly aware of the fact that we shouldn't be doing extraneous things, and that the load, be it the experimental load on the lunar surface or the load that we will put on them going out and coming back, needs to be as minimal as we can make it so they have time for contingencies and so we're not getting ourselves into a very crowded overall operation. Those concepts, by and large, are supposed to be built into all these talks.
I just wanted to emphasize them. I think they're the kind of things that you want to think about. Each of you probably will be able to add several more points to the ones that I've made. We still continue to run slightly ahead of schedule. I don't think we've been going long enough to warrant a coffee break, so I would suggest that we continue to load the timeline up somewhat and to move right on into Owen Maynard's presentation. Maynard, as you probably know, is chief of the Mission Operations Division within the Spacecraft Program Office here, and he has been the main architect of this overall symposium.
Owen? Thank you.